Well, welcome again to the Wilderness Acts Performance Series. You're now at the poetry performance area, and it is my honor to introduce Stephen Wing, an earth poet, journalist, and naturalist extraordinaire, to present a wonderful collection of poetry he put together after speaking too loudly in a quiet place.
Thank you. It's actually one poem, and I have it available in a chapbook if anyone wants to take it home with you. My name's Stephen Wing, and my love affair with nature began in the Boundary Waters canoe area in northern Minnesota. And I've carried that with me ever since, even living in Atlanta, even when I'm not able to get out of the city for long periods of time, it's always with me inside. So I'm really glad I was able to lure you all out here to this patch of woods, because when you leave, you can take it with you. And don't ever forget that it's here. After speaking too loudly in a quiet place. And it starts with a quote from Gary Snyder that I found after I had completed the poem. It just crossed my path in that mysterious way that nature works sometimes. To resolve the dichotomy of the civilized and the wild, we must first resolve to be whole. And hopefully the poem will be a longer way of saying that. It's in six parts. One. After speaking too loudly in a quiet place, it's natural to stop and look around a bit self-consciously, as if hoping for some kind of reply out of the silence. Still picking blackberry seeds out of my teeth with a dried pine needle, I set off down the path that winds and forks and circles through these 7 acres, eerily shaped like some abstract map of the state of Georgia. A wilderness where all the trees are labeled, and hoses lie coiled like snakes asleep among brown needles and duff. A garden where hawks hunt rabbits, chipmunks, and squirrels, and massive trunks lie rotting where they fell. Around the rim of this singing bowl of quiet, traffic swarms and howls like an army of chainsaws extending the territory of grief. Mowers and blowers rage from the apartment complex next door like shrill philosophers debating the futility of love. Jets and helicopters split the sky like the incoming rounds of an artillery of heartaches, while birds and insects patiently state the case for singing in the face of all we've lost. Two state highways cross a pine cone's throw from the southeast corner of the land. 30 feet below Scott Boulevard, stream water trickles from a concrete culvert, slowly shifting the bars of sand and gravel along its course, undercutting steep banks of clay where twisted tree roots hang through, rolling storm debris and random litter steadily downstream, as casually unstoppable as the roots and flowers and seeds of time. Like the spiral of seeds in a pine cone, biodiversity makes itself possible. Now we're on the edge of losing it in 3 human generations, biodiversity canceling itself out. 2. This garden was once a wilderness. Every garden was once a wilderness, home to a spider web of woven species that prospered by keeping each other in balance, including our wild ancestors, the human tribes, who have tended every wilderness on Earth with mystical science since mythological times. These Georgia foothills kept the peace between the mountain territory of the Cherokee and the rolling flatlands of the Creek, a neutral country where both could hunt and trade their goods beneath the cathedral arches of old-growth trees, whose leaves lay decaying under their moccasins like a carpet of rich brocade 100 millennia deep. Environment is just a French word for relationships. Then came the ships of civilization, cunningly constructed from the lost forests of Europe. These people with skin the color of Georgia clay, Creek and Cherokee alike, fell by thousands to European bacteria and European musket balls. Glinting flakes of gold drove the survivors into exile and hiding. The native translation of civilized must be insane. Who won these 7 acres in the lottery that divided Georgia into homesteads long before the Trail of Tears? No one remembers. But someone cleared and terraced a farm here, felling the ancient giants of the forest with crosscut and axe blade, leveling the hillside with pick and shovel, carving out a pocket of civilization in the heart of the wild with sweat and ingenuity and the patient labor of oxen or mules. Crops grew where steel plows sliced and turned the forest floor. The fallen leaves of centuries fed the ripening acres that nourished each new crop of children. Babies grew up and inherited the land, had babies of their own, grew old and died, and nourished in their turn the dirt that fed them. A city took hold nearby on the banks of the Chattahoochee and spread across these hills, continuously forested for 200 million years, like a plague of exotic insects, chewing trees into lumber, transforming the peaceful woods into a noisy junction of railroads, the wagon track at the farm's western border into a highway. The biggest tree still standing today in the city of Atlanta lives quietly next door to the stadium of a team called the Braves, behind a cancer center named for Our Lady of Perpetual Help. Ezekiel Mason was the first recorded owner, a merchant at first, according to census records, eventually a landowner, too rich to work, until General Sherman passed through, burning a blackened swath of ruin across the South. Ezekiel Mason grew old and died a farmer. The homestead might have been a wedding gift to his daughter, Caroline Elizabeth Mason, when she married Bushrod Randall in 1871. The city of ashes, reborn, ate whole hillsides of timber, swallowed town after town, filled the blank map between them with roads and houses and shops. Ezekiel's descendants gave up farming to work in offices and factories. In 1937, they sold the right-of-way for a dirt track across the farm, optimistically branded Scott Boulevard. As if farmland was only a natural phase in forest succession, the terraced fields gave way gradually to pine. The shadows of green boughs crept back across the furrows. The wild creatures had never really left. The water kept flowing through. But then the water is always wild, no matter what. 3. Two little pools of sky in the shadow of a tall magnolia. Two leaves lying on their backs like little boats filled with rain. Around the perimeter of this refuge and preserve for peace in its native habitat, morning traffic prowls the property line, roaring out a challenge to its wild rival, like 1,000 sawmills squaring planks. Revving motors rip a boundary between worlds, like drunken generals haggling over a banquet of hope, while the leafy canopy serenely soaks up sunshine, and the understory calmly blossoms in the shadow. Soft scalloped fungus, clustered thick as feathers on a chunk of old rotten log, suckling years of sunlight and rain out of the soft wood, leaving it sooner or later as light as an empty eggshell, chrysalis, cicada skin. Humans have inhabited every wilderness on Earth for so long that now the wilderness inhabits us. Whether or not we stop thinking and talking and texting long enough to peer into the dark inside, where two wary eyes reflect the original campfire that kindled all the fires of civilization, watching our progress along the path that long ago became a highway, as if quietly awaiting our return. Maybe that's why some of us can't help turning off on a gravel side road from time to time, leaving our vehicles behind to hike or paddle into that undeveloped region of the brain, where stars still swarm the night and wolves howl in the distance, exploring the threadbare patchwork of wilderness that remains like a penitent, retracing the steps of time. As a blind man learns to listen, hearing more than you meant to say, these trees have invented a whole new sense we walking ones can only wonder at. 4. This wilderness was once a garden. All wilderness was once a garden, whole and undivided and complete from shore to shore of a single landmass, christened Pangaea by the geologists, which explains why our native azalea, honeysuckle, magnolia, all have relatives in Asia, and why the two-legged tribes of every continent tell the same old tales in every tongue. A mossy brick walkway leads to the vanished front steps, where a house full of echoing memories once stood. A garden of camellia, azalea, hydrangea, and Japanese maple surrounds the trim lawn of a family's odd bequest to generations of strangers yet to be born. Sourwood, hickory, sassafras, water oak, arum, flowering dogwood, tall rattlesnake root, toadshade trillium, devil's walking stick, partridge berry, loblolly pine. Circe Bradfield Slack bought two lots of the old Randall farm at auction in 1943. On one, he built a house for his daughter Jean and her new husband, Chester Morse, a doctor who survived a Nazi prison camp and came home to raise children and flowers. Jean grew up walking the Georgia woods with her father, learning the names of trees, learning to love the land. When Chester came courting all the way from Massachusetts, the thing about this Yankee boy that finally won over Mrs. Slack was their mutual love of gardening. Chester came home from the living nightmare of a tour in hell, medical officer, prisoner of war, uncounted casualty of all the killing he saw. He came home to Jean and the place they began to call Woodlands. He came home every night from his grueling residency at the segregated city's hospital for the poor, from his private practice as it grew, and together they turned Woodlands into a garden. Winged elm, wild ginger, narrow-leaf silkgrass, money plant, mouse ears coreopsis, doll's eyes, wood vamp, little hip hawthorn, resurrection fern. In the winter of 1947, Chester's mother and father came to visit, hoping he could diagnose Winnie Morse's chronic abdominal pains. Harold Morse spent those weeks cutting back the honeysuckle vines that were slowly suffocating the old homestead, while his wife lay recovering from the surgery that revealed her fatal cancer. Chester and Jean were partners for 62 years, one at either end of the crosscut saw. They cleared out the invasives and planted natives, along with a fairyland of flowering exotics. They rescued native azaleas and wildflowers from construction sites before the bulldozers came. They ordered a Georgia native big-leaf magnolia all the way from Oregon, which grew up to be Atlanta's champion big-leaf magnolia. They never ran out of things to talk about. They never fell out of love. They built the modern brick house in 1951 with a picture window for Jean facing out over her flowers. Three half-wild daughters and a son roamed these woods, along with feral troops of brownies, Cub Scouts, and campfire girls. Jean taught them all the names of trees and her love for the land. American hornbeam, tulip tree, little brown jug, witch hazel, mountain laurel, pubescent lobelia, Christmas fern, Solomon's plume, creeping Jenny. A patch of open sky stands witness to a family's gift of garden and wilderness, the bricks and beams and pipes and wires lovingly recycled, an old woman's beloved picture window carefully dismantled to preserve the view. A sacrifice of childhood stories to feed the imaginations of city kids. Maybe those same kids I hear right now, shrieking and giggling from the pool across the fence, who might not even know the tallest dogwood tree in the whole USA lives right next door, or how easily this land could have been one more apartment complex just like theirs. The jets and helicopters pass over without comment. 5. Native plants will come right back if you just clear out the invaders. So what about native attitudes? Now comes the slow work of culling out the plants that don't belong, civilization's stowaways and well-intended imports that echo the arrogant mistakes of their masters, dominating the natives, feasting on opportunity, upsetting the balance that kept this land alive before they came. Amphitheater of split log benches, cushioned with moss, cracked and knotted and weathered, aligned in a triple rainbow, listening in silence to the silent oration of 3 split log chairs. Now the land offers up its gifts to complete the circle connecting past and future, giving our descendants a chance to forgive our ancestors for innocently enslaving this continent because they didn't understand their children's children would be native here someday. Glistening little lake in the concrete basin of a birdbath, fed by a thin tube from somewhere underground through the days without rain, tempting wanderers off the trail from a little circle of saplings in the cool shade of giants. Now we learn again how to haul a log out of the woods with a team of draft horses when it's time to thin out the pines. Now we learn how to reach living eyes, ears, and hearts with a keyboard and computer. Now we learn exactly how much a mismatched posse of volunteers who love this place can accomplish in a day, an hour, a year. Little bridge of planks across the ephemeral water and its miniature canyon, where 2 fallen limbs make dainty little waterfalls upstream and down, spanning the meandering flow like 2 mighty dams 1,000 feet below. 6. Civilization lives and grows like a climbing vine on the scarred and pitted trunk of the wild, each oblivious to the other. Partners in symbiosis or parasite and host? I sit here wondering on a mortared granite wall that marks the boundary between leaves full of sunlight and their shadows on the mown grass. Around the brim of this overflowing cup of birdsong and tree shadow, morning traffic marks its territory with oil stains and drifting exhaust. Cars rush at one another like feuding gangs of mechanical demons piloted by underpaid ghosts. Trees heckle the silence like a choir of demented TV commercials, turned up till the speakers burst, while all the time water trickles under and across and through every wall and fence and border ever devised by grown-up children playing divide and conquer. The cars race by on Scott Boulevard, 30 feet above an invisible concrete culvert, divided by a double yellow line, bound for an inscrutable destiny no matter which direction they fly. Civilization may or may not be doomed by its own headlong momentum, but this garden will survive. The wilderness will gradually return and return again. Our only hope may be to watch and listen and learn from its stubborn ways. Dancing cloud of tiny silver motes with wings, mad with ecstasy in a cascade of sun. Heart-shaped yellow leaf clinging to the exit sign. After contemplating in silence the orchestra of tranquil sounds that fills these woods within the walls of noise, I wake up with a start when my cell phone inevitably complains and I stand up to go. And right then, out of the ceaseless, rhythmless rumble of smoking engines and leaky transmissions beyond the shelter of the trees, out of the blur of distraction and hurry, out of the petrochemical trance and the haze of exhaustion, a gray minivan swings down the cracked and heaving drive. The man who steps out is dark as a native, the woman pale as the restless pilgrims who colonized this land. He carries the picnic basket. 2 little girls and an even smaller boy run ahead, chattering in a language I can't identify. Another woman appears and disappears between the foliage on a distant path, pushing a stroller. The birds twitter and coo, uninterrupted. Now this wilderness is complete. The garden flowers again and bears fruit, loaded with seeds. Every seed, a future, made possible yet again. Sorry to go on so long. I had to stop coming back here because I was afraid it would get longer. But now I can come back all I want. And you can too. Please don't be a stranger. The garden is open. Daylight hours.